And welcome again to Back to the Future. I'm Martin Raymond, and this is the podcast where we speak of the innovators of today who are changing and making tomorrow happen. My guest this week has worked as a senior policy advisor for science and technology at the Obama White House. She is also the founder and CEO of Fly Science Enterprise, which is really an educational multimedia consultancy that uses the power of storytelling to, quote her, promote social change for children and teenagers of colour who are keen to pursue careers in science and technology. Her work, she tells me, utilises data, science and evidence-based insights, along with a framework she describes as augmented futures that helps children and teenagers to describe and unlock their future lives through storytelling. So successful has she been as a scientist, she regularly serves as a science consultant for TV shows, including Netflix Add a Twist, Scientists, where one of the key characters, Wild Specs included, is modelled on her childhood self. Today, her glasses are bigger, her science, tech and innovation accolades even greater, but she still tells me she suffers from imposter syndrome. And daily has a sense that little girl in the big glasses still has a very long way to go. Well, I think we know better. Dr. Natoki Ford, thank you for joining us. Dr. Natoki Ford, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
A pleasure. I mean, we have chatted previously because we were introduced through a mutual friend, Aslam Tuskant, who was, strangely enough, because, you know, I've known Aslam for years, she was writing a paper about imposter syndrome. So naturally, she called me and said, Martin, I need to interview you for this paper, because really, you know, I guess being a CEO of a company, being gay, not really having any training in business whatsoever, she said, of course, I must speak to you. But when she mentioned you, I was going, hang on a minute. You've got a PhD in biomedics. You're a senior policy advisor at the Obama White House. Wow, okay. A science consultant. We will come back to this for Disney and Netflix, as well as being highly successful, a social entrepreneur in helping children realize their potential in science, technology, and math. So while I get why she was interviewing me, why was she talking to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Well, first I'll say it's a little bit of a beautiful irony that she wound up connecting me to you, because at that time, this was back in February of this year, I was at the very early stages of thinking about anything even remotely related to the future. And I had to overcome imposter feelings a bit even to ask her to make the introduction to you, because, you know, I don't know anything about this space. And she mentioned it in her introduction when we did our interview. And so it's a wonderful indicator of that it's a journey in terms of like imposter syndrome and how these feelings can pop up. And so for me, my imposter feelings began when I was a graduate student, when I first began my PhD at Harvard. And it was this big culture shock of coming from a historically Black university in the South, you know, here in the US, and then transitioning to this Ivy League institution. So it was like all these different changes I was going through. And it's also very common for people who go through transitions like this to start to have these sort of imposter feelings that can pop up. And if you're not intentional at keeping them at bay, they can just grow and fester until you really just develop severe self-doubt. You can have anxiety, you can become depressed. So it's really, you know, a significant issue. So it's definitely something that I can't say I'm cured of, but I have developed a system to manage and keep it at bay. But yeah, it can happen to anyone.
It is interesting because I always think I kind of read quite a lot on your background and, you know, thinking about the work you have done. And I was thinking, actually, a lot of overcoming that kind of syndrome is about having a purpose. So you kind of really are focused on something that sits in the future. I guess the key part also was a passion. And that was one of the things that when I was watching actually one of your TED lectures, it was this sense of passion that you brought to it. So I'm just going to look at those three words, a sense of purpose, a belief, and a passion. But you mentioned in a previous call we had this notion of enablement and having people who would be there to help you. And I just wanted you to perhaps talk about how you see from your career and this shift from perhaps feeling like an imposter to being the person you are now. How were you enabled, and were there people there to help you realize that there was a different journey ahead of you than the one you potentially imagined?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even from childhood, I can think about my enablers. We're very fortunate to have great parents who neither of which had a college degree, but were just always big proponents of the importance of an education. And just also instilling in me this belief that if I was willing to work hard and just apply myself, I could do anything. And so I had a great foundation in childhood. I had great teachers. There was a teacher actually going back to sixth grade who told me she saw me becoming senior class president in high school. So it was like someone speaking to potential and actually speaking life to potential that they see in you is really powerful. And it was just having these women who were just a part of my life at a critical point where, again, I'm in grad school, I'm in the throes of these feelings of like, who am I to think I can, you know, get a PhD, let alone one from Harvard? And it was just, it started with my advisor telling me, well, you're in grad school to learn. If you knew everything, you wouldn't need to be here. And also, it was this idea, and the thing that I love to celebrate in my beautiful friendship that formed with Magali, Dr. Sanjin, yes, is undoing and unlearning things that I thought that you had to be and look like as a woman in science. You know, people are listening, so they can't see what I look like right now, but I've got on like a fabulous sort of, you know, purplish lipstick, big, you know, glasses. And I never thought that women could be into fashion or makeup and be taken seriously as a scientist. So there was all these things that I had to sort of unlearn and think about how I was trying to change myself to fit into a box that ultimately didn't apply to me. And so I think all that being said, it was just people who removed a bit of the fantasy in terms of like thinking that you get to these places and it's easy. And if it's not easy, then, you know, you shouldn't be here. And in reality, everybody has to work and learn and sometimes struggle. And so I think it was a combination of removing that idea that difficulty is a signal you don't belong, but also that you have to change yourself to fit in. You don't want to fit in. You want to belong. And the only way you belong is by bringing your whole truest self to any space that you occupy. And that's really the only way that you'll ever contribute your fullest value.
See, I'm thinking about there are two pictures. I say shy young girl wearing big blue glasses. I don't know if you were shy, but I was just thinking about the picture with these pink ball grips in your hair. And then jump cut to this confident, witty scientist delivering a TED lecture. Apart from the enablers that worked with you, how did you imagine yourself forward into that person and that moment from that girl who, you know, I think you do describe yourself as being shy?
I think it really boils down to, you hit on it a little bit earlier about developing a passion for something and developing a passion for something outside of yourself. And I think when I was able to focus on something that felt bigger than myself and something that I wanted to do to help make the world a better place in whatever, you know, way. And that vision started out with, so I'm partially blind in one eye. So it was like, okay, I want to do something in science to help people with blindness. And so that's how it started as a kid. And that's how I ended up going to grad school and studying a disease that causes blindness. It's called age-related macular degeneration. But then it continued to evolve. Then when I took a break. So one thing that is probably also on my website is I took a leave from grad school after one semester. I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this. I had this transformative experience out in Los Angeles as a teacher, as a substitute teacher, which was really game-changing for me because it gave me a chance to connect with children. It's my first time working as an educator. And to see that sense of, okay, if there were these feelings that I had about not feeling smart or not good enough to be at a place like Harvard, if they could be so detrimental to me as an adult that I could leave school, like just, you know, take a break from grad school, then how damaging could they be to a kid in the seventh grade who feels that way? And so it just gave rise to this sense of like, I really want to do something to help people, especially kids who don't you know, who feel like they have limitations, who feel like society has low expectations of them, and to help them have a sense of greater possibility for themselves beyond even their circumstances that they may currently be in. And so all that being said, that's really what helped me make that transition from the kind of shy little girl to even sometimes I'm still that shy, you know, fearful woman, but it's again, this outer sense of purpose and something bigger than myself that helps me just push through and to overcome, because it's not really just about me looking good or sounding good, but it's about really wanting to do something impactful to help other people. And that's been really instrumental.
Wow. So you're unpacking quite a lot of things there. So I'm going to just, you know, hold it for a moment and talk about the notion of the story. I mean, you have the sense of, because I listen to you, you tell stories. You also have a reflective sense of how, by telling the story, we have to kind of to think differently, to have a different kind of empathy, I think. But also it allows us to unlock things that maybe we're not really accessing when we just go to the fact or talk about the science of something. But you also started or have started on this journey. You know, you did say when we spoke previously, you haven't quite formulated the thing yet, which is more fascinating to me because the story is beginning. And you use the phrase augmented futures, because to me, storytelling can be about the past. So we're commenting on something by reflecting on it, or about bridge building and allowing us to create pathways into areas that previously didn't exist. How are you describing these augmented futures, and what are you trying to do when you introduce this phrase to the world?
Yeah, so with augmented futures, and I've changed the name of this idea like four times in the 4 months. I just started on this path. And actually, I have to pause it and thank you again for, you were one of the first people that I talked to about this project that actually is a person that operates in kind of futures and foresight. And it was, again, you talk about enablers. It was your receptiveness to it that also gave me that encouragement to just keep going and keep pursuing it. And so I've settled on augmented futures in the sense of, if you remember that toy from the 80s, it was called a ViewMaster. Do you remember it? It was like,
I have vintage ViewMasters, would you believe? I love them.
They're so cool. Like they were, you know, trying to do 3D, but you were clicking through, right? And you were seeing different images. Every time you pressed a button, you flip through. So imagine when we invite a child to hold up their own ViewMasters about their futures and to say, here's the initial image you might have of what your future could be. Now let's press a button and see what other possibilities that might exist for you that maybe you hadn't even considered before. Because a large part of what has motivated me for this work as well is the privilege sometimes comes through exposure. When you get exposed to different things and exposed to different possibilities, but when you have no sense, you don't know what you don't know, right? And so a large part of what augmented futures and what I endeavor to do with this is to expand that possibility through exposing kids to what their futures could be. And so that's expanding possibilities, so augmenting the future by adding different possibilities to it. But it's also, what are the things we can do today to actually improve what those outcomes could be and not just sort of accept the projections as they are, but to be proactive in developing strategies and innovations to really improve and enhance what those future possibilities could be?
Wow. I mean, that's such a powerful idea, because I still to this day, I meet a lot of clients. Now in my head, I think, are you a pilot or a passenger? You know, do you drive this thing? Because the future hasn't happened. We have to create it. You know, in some ways we have to decide what this thing should, could, will look like. And then with our agency, set out to bring that to pass. And a lot of future trends and planning, I think, become very privileged about, you know, the people who create them. I kind of suspect that a lot of time when I'm working with people on scenarios or future visualizations or developing frameworks for looking at tomorrow, they are quite hygienic and very much about optimization rather than the realities. So I'm just wondering, when you start thinking about the tools and mechanisms, how will you build that right for children to see those differences and to understand that it's the difference that makes the future more opportunistic and more welcoming rather than just it being singular and monocultural. Have you kind of gone that far with the thinking yet?
Yeah, it's a great question. And one thought that I have had that I definitely I'm excited to explore how to integrate this is it builds off of something that I've come to observe and learn through my public speaking. So if I do an event, I would say one of my greatest strengths is my willingness to be vulnerable, my willingness to, again, as you said, I'm not painting an hygienic version of myself or what my path has been. And so I think as a part of that, and also I think a part of why, you know, it never fails after I do a talk where, especially where I talk about imposter syndrome, someone comes up to me afterwards and is crying and wants to give me a hug because I have normalized something that is perhaps very painful in their experience, but not just normalize it, but I've shown them that it's possible to overcome. And so I think that as a part of that, to your point, we have to be realistic about the challenges and the perceived barriers that are up against these kind of, you know, fictional versions of the, you know, perfect, no, everybody looks the same. We don't have differences. We don't disagree. So I think we have to create space for helping kids see those potential, you know, challenges, but to see a path to navigate them in a way. Again, it's not to say that it's going to be perfect, but to use it as a sort of a character building. And then ultimately, imagine, you know, when you've faced something that felt difficult, but then you overcome and you succeed, it makes a success that much sweeter because you knew what you were up against. And so I think using these scenarios and helping kids iterate their own futures, we're not leaving out the trials and tribulations or even neglecting or ignoring the barriers in their present realities. I think that's the part where we can't act like everything is perfect for them and then assume that they're going to be able to extrapolate onto something that they don't have a frame or reference for. So I think it's a combination of engaging them in both what matters to them, what feels important, but also what they see as a challenge and as a barrier and helping them see a path to overcoming that. So I think that's a really critical part of it. All that being said, I'm excited because I don't know the answer just yet.
Yeah, that's part of the journey, isn't it? I always think it's this huge debate about, you know, heritage versus legacy. This is why I always remind people about the notion of visualization, of frameworks, of scenarios. It's not imagining just what we would like the thing to be. It's playing out the realities of where we are now, but by finessing, nuancing, questioning, challenging, it could mean that the future is better. And therefore, we've now built a pathway to design that betterness, if that's a term, into the future more effectively and quickly. What I kind of be more curious about is why particularly did you become interested in that concept of using the future as a tool or a mechanism to enable people to think and be different? What was the kind of the origins of that process?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm fairly new. I'm not even quite a year into sort of starting to explore in this. Ironically, I was at a point actually about a year ago where I was in this space of feeling like I wasn't living up to my potential. I have this habit of reinventing myself every 5 to 7 years. So I'm in that window of like, what next? You've been doing this thing for these last several years and it's fine, but it feels like there should be more. There's something more you need to be doing. And I didn't know what that was. And I wound up attending a retreat on the business of space. And I'm sitting in a breakout session around the pipeline. We're talking about, of course, science and tech careers and how we always talk about the leakiness of the pipeline. We're losing kids. Like, how do we, you know, address this? And there's a woman, Kara Kunzman, I might be mispronouncing her last name, at Aerospace. She is sitting on taking up the helm of an organization called Teach the Future. So she wasn't even, I think, in that role when she posed this question, but I have to give her credit because she posed this question to the group that said, how are we preparing kids for jobs that don't exist yet? And it was this question, this singular question that turned on a light bulb for me. Because again, there was this creative element to it. There was a storytelling component of it. But it was this idea of engaging kids in the future in a way and thinking about we think about even 10, 15 years ago, there are jobs now, 20 years ago, that didn't exist 20 years ago, right? And so it's what a fun and creative exercise of using the appeal of the future, but not just to focus on, this is a big piece of it too, not just to focus on skills and preparation, which is important, but to focus on inspiration. That to me is a critical part. There was the committee I worked for when I was a fellow in the Obama White House. My first job there was the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, PCAST. And they had a report that came out in 2010 that was called Prepare and Inspire. And it was all about changing STEM education. So I bring that up to say that I think many times the focus is only on preparation, but we can never underscore the importance of inspiration. And so that is where, for me, the focusing on the future and using this exercise of imagining and envisioning futures as a tool to basically formalize inspiration within educational context. So that's where it all began for me. And I'm not even, as I said, a year from this conversation, and it's just been an amazing experience that I've had, again, connecting with you and every person that I have a conversation with. I've built great momentum. It's like you pose that question, people are like, oh my gosh, I get it.
Because I guess it's like the notion of STEM, you know, which people will talk a lot about. And certainly in the UK, making sure the science, technology, maths, engineering are key parts of the student's progression. But also, there has been an increased emphasis on STEAM. So the A, the art bit. And I think this is what you've hit on, is this sense that the art or culture and imagination, inspiration, this ability to think beyond and differently is suddenly now part of the student journey and progression. I remember we were chatting about what you mentioned about children in some ways don't make those distinctions initially. So their imagination is full flight and allowing them perhaps to take that forward, because I always think, just as children learn from adults, a lot of adults, certainly with a lot of the businesses and organizations I work with and CEOs, could learn from children. Because so many times in meetings, when you say, imagine this, they say, but we can't because it's not possible. You know, our budgets don't allow it. There's a limitation on our logistics, our supply chain. And as soon as I hear that in any kind of meeting, I think, oh my goodness, how dull your business and corporation and kind of personal life must be if you refuse imagination at the very moment you need it. It's when we doubt it. It's when we need to pull it into play. So again, I felt, and I do feel with the journey you're on, that it won't stop just looking at education. I think you've hit on something that businesses and organizations increasingly need to do. Otherwise, they just stumble from polycrises to polycrises without imagining how we can escape this thing.
I love that. And I think what you're, it's something that I've been hearing a lot and I've been sort of trying to embody is, have you heard of this expression, like being a high vibration person?
No, go tell me.
Well, it's really getting at the heart of what you're mentioning. It's kind of like another way of saying half glass full versus half empty person. Are you a person that tries to envision the best possible outcomes? Do you only see limitations or do you see opportunities even in things that feel? And so that is something that, and I've also gotten into meditation more recently, and there's this app that I use, and I was doing a course recently, and the teacher mentioned that the way we maintain a high vibration way of living is to embody the frequency of trust. Because when you trust, that means that you have it's sort of trust also connected with faith. You have a belief that something is going to work out. You don't know how, you don't have to control. And as a person who's a recovering perfectionist, workaholic, type A.
Right. Recovering perfectionist. I'm going to steal that term.
Well, because you want things to work out based off of what you know, or you want it to work out a certain way. But when you don't feel, or you don't restrict yourself off of what you can currently see or what even you think you have, then you open up possibilities that you hadn't even considered before. So that's the high vibration way of living.
I kind of understand that perfectly, because I always think I'm the ultimate pessimist in that I always set out with the catastrophic view. And then I think curiously, I think inquiringly, I think, you know, joyously is the term that I think people forget about, you know, to approach something with joy. I mean, if you approach the future with joy, how different that would be than the kind of dystopian images that we normally think about when we think about tomorrow.
Exactly.
So I kind of feel that vibration and the trust is a key part of it, because the future, and I think this is why trust is such an important part of business, of thinking, of organizational behavior, is that we have sort of pushed trust out of the equation because it's difficult to measure. It's like reciprocity. You know, it's like all of those things that we go, well, how do you measure that? And what do I get in return? So the trust is something that, and it's an interesting question, how many people trust the future? I guess very few, because it's so unknown that everybody is suspicious. I've been suspicious of change. I mean, you know, I love change. The majority of people I know fear it. So I'm guessing I'm going to put trust into that. But I'm just aware of our time together. And I'm kind of thinking, my little alarm clock is going off and saying, Martin, you've got to ask Natoki about the bit where we step into a time machine, which is where we are now. So now that we've discussed what you know, and I've had some of you thinking about where potentially you will take this sense of augmented futures, we're going to step into the time machine. So there's going to be a bit of dry ice whizzing past us, a bit of lightning, screeching wheels. I think you know what kind of time machine I'm talking about, a bit of burning rubber. And we're going to shoot back into the past and we're going to stop. And we're perhaps going to stop with that young girl with the big glasses who's not knowing what's going to happen. If you had to bring things back to help change, not her past, but to help change the present we're in, what is it, knowing what you know now, you would do to make things different? What are the things you would think about?
You know, it's a really good question, a really interesting question. And one thought that I have that sort of goes to what you mentioned earlier around the movement to incorporate the A in arts into STEAM, because I think unfortunately what has happened in the last several years is there's been this sort of removal of liberal arts from like education, like public school education here in the United States. And part of what I think is unfortunate is this idea. Again, I am a big proponent of STEM education and focusing on technical things, but I don't think that means that we need to do away with the arts and these other things, because I do see them as also critical for development and for inspiring critical thinking skills and creativity. And so I think that, and sadly, especially here in the US, that many of the schools that are losing and where the budgets are being cut and that are losing funding for these programs are in areas where it's primarily, you know, kids of color, low income. And so it's this kind of stealth way of contributing and exacerbating existing inequities when you think that liberal arts education and learning is not important. And again, I'm not saying it's not important for, we shouldn't continue to push for STEM skills, but we can't, you know, do that at the detriment of not thinking that the arts are not important as well. When we think about developing a generation of people who are well-rounded in what they know and the skills that they possess. And so I think that's a piece that I'm like, something that I've learned or that I've observed. And I could even say it in how I've benefited in my, you know, my own upbringing and my own education, how I benefited from, you know, having different courses into doing performing arts and just these different things and how it has helped my educational experience. So I hope that we can disrupt that trend.
I mean, if you look at the research observances in neuroscience, that, you know, parts of the brain that light up when somebody's composing a piece of music or writing a poem are not dissimilar to the parts that happen when you enter high-level abstract mathematics. And I always think that the, you know, two of them are probably equally similar. I'm thinking of Contact, the film based on the Carl Sagan book, same name, Jodie Foster, where she's looking, having been transported through time and space, she's looking at this strange instrument that sits on the foreshore. And she says, and this is why I always think why the A is important in STEM, she says they should have sent a poet. Like, in other words, only a poet could understand such extraordinary abstraction and change and disruption. And I think that's kind of why I'm with you on this. And I think, you know, that's one of the things I'd like to go back and reinsert into the historic timeline is the A in the way that it's been gouged out and moved and segregated. So that would certainly be with you. We're back in the car again. I didn't say car. I can't say car because of copyright issues. We're stepping back into our time machine and we're hurtling forward. So now that you're beginning your journey on your augmented futures, you've had a chance to watch the kind of children and teenagers you've been working with change and grow. You've got your professional practice in the area like science, technology, maths. We're now in 2034 thereabouts, so a decade ahead. What would you hope to see that would recognize and carry some of the changes that you've been trying to instigate in kind of society and culture today?
Well, one, I would hope to see that this exercise of engaging children in the process of envisioning their futures and iterating futures, we create their personalized view masters, it's become standard. It's a part of our education, where we don't just say you can be anything you want to be, but then we don't give them something to really wrap their heads around. So I think my hope for the future is that in a decade, this can be not only become standard, but where we're also beginning to see this. The thing that breaks my heart is, you know, we've been putting millions of dollars, billions of dollars in trying to reform education and improve outcomes in terms of, you know, when you think about the achievement gap, there are all these gaps, the achievement gap, there's the digital divide, but we haven't really moved the needle in measurable ways in decades. And so what is that thing that we're going to do together finally that's going to start to disrupt those negative trends? And my hope is that maybe this, again, is this opportunity where we're leveraging this idea of augmenting our futures with kids as a way to create more inspiring learning experiences that begin to translate into their actual outcomes in terms of educational attainment and even careers that they may pursue and operate in. So that's my hope, is that we use this as in a structured way, that it becomes systematic. Inspiration has become formalized in educational context, but that we also have measurable results. And we may not see them in a decade, but we at least can see the momentum start to shift. And also where we have a structure in place that it becomes not just one-off activities, but something that is regularly implemented and that everyone is universally accessible as well.
Wow. It sounds like there's a really good book there in future telling. That would be my term for where you're putting in place or teaching. And it's not just children, I think it's adults as well, how to build better futures. But, you know, the way that we teach people the skills for, you know, becoming a business person, or the skills for becoming a scientist, skills for becoming a teacher, we're not teaching the skills for improving our tomorrow. We think it's left to other people, governments, organizations, you know, the wider community. But I think what you have clearly identified throughout our conversation together is that, A, it has to begin with us, despite the barriers and the oppositions. If we can teach some frameworks and tools to people, it equips them and arms them better for the journey ahead. So I'm just going to stop on that and ask you, is there a word, one word that you think sums up your thoughts, hopes, ambitions for tomorrow? Like just a thing we can take away with us and meditate on?
Yes. One word that sums up my hopes and ambitions for tomorrow is thrive. I think if we can enable everyone to have a sense of thriving, and that doesn't just necessarily mean in sort of economic sense, but well-being, and just, you know, one of my favorite quotes by Maya Angelou is, success is liking myself, liking what I do, and liking how I do it. And that's what thriving is. And so using these tools and developing a framework for enabling people to thrive in their lives in every possible sense of what that means.
Well, I'm going to give you thrive. Mine would be empathy, which I think is not hugely different. I always think to have or to do the other, you need the former, or vice versa. They kind of sit as two things together. Thank you for spending time with us. If people want to know, which they will want to know more, in the Natoki4.com, I guess people will find you there. The TED lecture is there if people want to watch it. Your current thinking, because I suspect I'm going to find more updates on the augmented futures. So I will be staying tuned. And everybody else, as usual, to keep listening, keep looking, keep learning. I think we spent a lot of time talking about learning today. And of course, keep asking what's new and what's next.